Welcome to this afternoon's edition of At the Root of It. This is Aaron Fitzpatrick broadcasting out of Roberta's Restaurant in Brooklyn on the 21st of July. Rainy, kind of cold afternoon today. Thank you to our sponsor, Testa Wines, a family-owned business in the wine world since 1962. And to our producer today, Lorenzo Ragioneri, and engineer, EJ Dukoski. We're going to start today's show with the Week in Wine recap. First news being that ice wine is being produced in Brazil for the very first time. The Perico Winery has begun producing the ice wine and plans to sell and export it beginning October 2010. The grapes making the ice wine will be Cabernet Sauvignon, and they're coming from a vineyard located near the town of Sao Joaquim, which is about 1,300 meters above sea level in the coastal state of Santa Catarina. Seems a bit odd or unusual given Brazil's tropical climate, but it's noted that the temperatures drop regularly to 7.5 degrees negative Celsius, so they can get very low, and they've realized it was one day possible to produce this type of wine there. In other news, a report published last week in the Florence edition of the Italian national daily Repubblica names the five wineries officially cited by the Italian authorities for cutting and softening their wines. It was known as the Brunello dispute last year. The winemakers Antinori, Argiano, Banfi, Casanova de Neri, and Marchese di Frescobaldi have been cited by the Italian Treasury Department for releasing wines not in conformity with appellation regulations. According to the report, Biondi Santi and Col d'Orsia were also investigated but cleared of any wrongdoing. And lastly, Galt Milo editor resigns following winemaker's boycott. This is Germany's most famous wine tasting guide, the Galt Milo, and after 14 top winemakers called for the boycott of the magazine, the editor stepped down. The controversy began on June 30th when German winemakers sent an open letter to the magazine, its publisher, Christian Verlag, indicating that they would not send samples to be tasted for review because they objected to the publisher's new optional donation, quote-unquote, of 195 euros for the tasting. Donhoff was one of the people who signed this and said that the tastings would not have necessarily favored those who did pay, but the perception was raised for those who would have paid. It would have been fine had they asked for money after the publishing. The wine judgments are independent regardless if winemakers paid or not, they claim. However, everyone was just turned off by the general movement for that. So that about wraps it up. We're going to take a quick break. And this is a song by our producer, engineer today, EJ Dukoski, who's a keyboardist, songwriter in the band Brian Bonds and the Dot Hongs. This is Sea Fence. Welcome back to At the Root of It. This is Aaron Fitzpatrick at the Heritage Radio Network, www.heritageradionetwork.com. And I'm here today with Dick Bessie. And Dick Bessie is a bread maker and responsible for getting the bread program at Roberta's Restaurant up and running. So welcome today, Dick.
Thanks, Aaron. It's good to be here.
Thank you. Well, we just had an idea. We were sitting in the garden not too long ago, maybe a couple months back, the sun's shining, and I said, hey, we should do a show sometime. And Dick said, let's do fermentation. I said, perfect. You're in bread, I'm in wine, two things that are fermented. Let's discuss and break down what it is.
Absolutely.
So a little bit about your background before we get kind of into the specifics of fermentation. You have a bakery that you had started in North Carolina.
Right. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of in mothballs right now because we're here waiting on the timing to move back to North Carolina. So that's going to hold off. It's a farmer's market target and things like an email list so that you're not really trying to go after the large bakeries and get enough up into their radar that they begin to give you a hard time. And right now what we've got here is the program that gets bread for internal use for Roberta's. They are selling the bread outside at several farmers markets. And this fall, we're going to install a whole area that's devoted to baking and a new wood-burning brick oven that is more headed towards bread than pizza, although mm-hmm. it'll still do pizzas. And that's going to be sort of mid to late fall when that thing actually gets launched, and you'll see a whole bunch of different new breads come out of there.
Excellent.
So it's kind of exciting.
Yeah, so right now you're producing a couple different styles. I had a lovely sandwich today on a bread that was a... What kind of bread was that? We had the porchetta sandwich.
That's just a simple sourdough boule, as it's called, a round loaf that starts out probably 3 inches high and in the oven comes up to like 4.5, and you get that nice tight structure. We also do these shaped into batards, sort of the long, fat, short baguette kind of shape that also make pretty decent sandwiches. But I think the boules give the bread's flavor a little more chance to come out.
Sure.
But these are all sourdough breads. There's mostly or all white flour in these. We were not doing a lot of work with whole wheat yet, but that's something that we're going to be progressing into fairly fairly strongly with the bakery coming up in the fall.
That's good. I love those grain breads.
We have a couple of ones that we tried here. A bread that I do that is what's called 100% hydration. So that for every kilogram of flour, there's a kilogram of water. It's very wet dough, and it's 100% whole wheat. It gives you a very, very interesting flavor.
Hmm.
So by the time we do one of those, you'll have to come back and try that.
I'm sure I will.
give you another excuse to be here.
Exactly. Well, that's exciting. So we have an oven on its works at Roberta's in the backyard, and probably some more exposure in farmers markets in the city and in the boroughs.
Hope so.
That's great. So can we define for our listeners fermentation?
Wow.
Generally speaking.
Just generally speaking, I guess the microbiologists in the audience will probably tear their hair out and say, what in the world is this guy talking about? But you have an outside agent, for instance, like yeast or something of that nature that's causing through almost a digestive process of its own a chemical change in the food that it's working on, in this case flour, and its byproducts just happen to be very beneficial to what we're looking for here: carbon dioxide and alcohol. In your case, the alcohol is great. In my case, the carbon dioxide is great because that's what makes the thing start to rise. And you get changes in the structure of the food. It's very difficult, for instance, to just digest straight starch. By the time the fermentation's taken its complete path, you can digest bread pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
A non-alcohol sort of fermentation where you've got bacteria working, lactobacillus-type bacteria and so on, where you get cheese and yogurt and those kinds of milk products, and you get vegetable products like, say, kimchi and so on, you get pretty serious changes in the way in the structure of the food, and it tends to make a lot of these things more digestible. People who have immune system compromises often find that fermented foods are much gentler on their digestive systems.
Mm-hmm. So when people talk about bread and how it makes them, well, some people, let's say, makes them full, or it's not as easy to digest. You know, there's obviously, you know, things like gluten-free and mm-hmm. things that might be easier for people to digest. But are there certain characteristics within different breads that might make bread easier to digest?
Well, if you have whole grain flours, a lot of people find that if they go for, and this is true of people who are trying to get a lot of whole grains in their diets, period,
mm-hmm.
They tend to, you feel, my God, I'm full, I've got really serious gas problems or something of that nature. This is something that you get a lot when you're putting a lot of whole grains in your body as you're just beginning to. I think that I've never had anybody say, I'm full from eating bread, unless they've been sitting eating a lot of bread and mm-hmm. they feel like they've just, you know, they're just really loaded up on food.
Right.
But if you have, if you do have an issue with grains, you know, whole grains and those kinds of things, like if you go to that or you're eating a lot of beans and what have you, you tend to right. get a little gas and there's a little sort of digestive until your body gets used to it. And then that problem usually goes away.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So generally speaking, we'll look at fermentation as a conversion of a carb, i.e. A sugar, mm-hmm. into an acid
right.
or an alcohol.
Right.
Okay.
Absolutely.
And then when we speak of wine, we think about the yeast, which is being added to the sugar grape juice component mm-hmm. To then create alcohol.
Right. And you get carbon dioxide out of that fermentation also, mm-hmm. like beer, champagne.
Right.
And but most of the still wines, of course, are done with uncapped tanks, or at least vented, so there's no, you don't trap it down in and make really effervescent wine unless you want it.
Right, exactly. Open top.
Right.
Yeah, open tank. When we think about the history of fermentation, it sounds like there's quite a bit of studies going back to document how foods were fermented and preserved over time and how they've, you know, generally made their way into modern day society.
I think a lot of fermented foods were sort of accidental discoveries. Mm-hmm. The classic example for bread, for instance, is that the Egyptians were making bread 6,000 years ago, but more than likely, the breads that they were making were just combinations of water and grain, and then they were just baked sort of like a flat biscuit almost with mm-hmm. no leavening at all. And the speculation is that some baker had a hunk of dough left over at the end of the day that was left sitting out and came back the next day, and it was kind of bubbly, and it smelled kind of interesting, and they put it in the oven and discovered that it was not only a better texture, but had a terrific flavor to it, and then set about some way of trying to reproduce that or replicate it on a day-to-day basis. Mm-hmm. And so then you wound up with leavened breads, and as you well know, when you have sourdough, you get a lot better flavor than if you just take water and flour and mash them together and throw it in as a big monster cracker in the oven.
Yeah.
So that was more than likely an accident. My guess is that beer and wine were accidental discoveries as well, just
That's
for the same kind
say.
Of reason.
They say Dom Perignon went to his cellar one day and saw something bubbling, and thus, mm-hmm. you know, the history of champagne started from his cellar, his cave.
Right. I understand he was quite happy about it.
He did settle upon a small gold mine in that cave, yes.
No kidding. And, you know, again, you know, things like cheese and yogurt and the like, if you are milking a cow and you leave the bucket of milk out, there are little beasties living there that may indeed take over, and you wind up with something that's changed character, changed flavor, it's a different texture, it's coagulated, and you know, things like salting cheese and what have you, I'm sure somebody put on his thinking cap and said, well, if it does it this way by accident, maybe if we can sort of push the process that way and then use salt to preserve it, that would do the trick.
Mm-hmm.
It would be difficult, given the state of the art of science that many centuries ago, to assume that somebody had said, "Oh, I'm going to make yogurt today,"
right?
and found the right, you know, immediately the right temperature and what have you.
Right.
So,
well, we're going to continue to speak a bit about the history and also the different types of fermentation, different kinds of it, right after we come back from this quick break.
Thank you. is breaking, but I don't care. Smash the rest up, burn it down. Put us in the corner, cause we're into ideas. Take these edges, they're inside out. No one will notice, they're looking elsewhere. We can be honest, we call it off. We got the choice.
Welcome back to At the Root of It. This is Aaron Fitzpatrick. And I'm here today with Dick Bessie, bread maker, and one of the driving forces behind the bread program here at Roberta's Restaurant in Brooklyn. And today we're talking about fermentation. And just to do a brief recap for our listeners as to what exactly fermentation is before we get further into discussion, we'll do a quick recap on that, because it is something that I think for people who aren't in the industry, until you see it actually happening, it's hard to understand how it actually occurs and how it changes. And I know when I went down to a winery to see firsthand, to work in the cellar, to see the grapes coming in from the vine, crushing the grapes, and then putting them into a tank, and then getting these yeast and seeing the reaction between the grape juice and the yeast. Not until then was I finally like, this is how you make wine.
Right. And if you start with a jug of grape juice and you're trying to figure out how that process, how it becomes alcoholic, the yeasts actually consume sugar, and alcohol and carbon dioxide are waste products. It's like we breathe in oxygen and we breathe out carbon dioxide and whatever else. And the yeasts just simply consume and they feed off the sugar. Yeah. And you get alcohol and you get the carbon dioxide out of it. In fact, you get dry wines by the yeasts consuming all of the sugar that they can get their little hands on. And if you have a wine that has so, or a grape juice that has so much sugar in it that the yeasts basically generate enough alcohol to kill themselves before they consume it all, you'll wind up with sweeter wine.
Right. So some people will stop that fermentation in order to you halt fermentation.
Right. You can halt it. You can halt it artificially. Say that three times really fast, and you will wind up with a wine that's off dry a little bit.
Right.
And
so the heat component then. So when the yeast are feeding off of the sugar, there's heat that's
it does
created.
Generate some heat. So I imagine that if you're wanting to keep things slow, you'll have a jacketed fermentation tank that's running cold water around it, so you keep that whole thing chilled down.
Right.
And
so some of the tanks in different cellars, you'll see if you go to a visit a winery in the cellar, there'll be streams of water coming down one of the stainless steel tanks in order to cool the juice inside so that it's a slower fermenting wine.
Right. And I was about to generalize, and I shouldn't. I think you see that a lot more in white wines than you do in reds. And you see, you certainly, if you are in a very hot climate, you don't want to have the temperatures climbing through the ceiling and ruining the grape juice before it gets fermented. So you probably want to be able to keep some kind of controls on that.
Sure.
Regardless of what color wine you're making and mm-hmm. what your finished product's supposed to look like.
Definitely. I think when I was in the winery down in Chile, we did three or four times a day checking, you know, the density, the volume, and the temperature of the tank so that mm-hmm. you're regulating that temperature so it doesn't go all wild on you.
yeah, absolutely. And you have things like... If you're talking about fermentations that are the sort of lactobacillic type fermentations, I think you're...
I.e. yogurt,
like yogurt
cheese.
And cheese and so on, you're looking basically at chemical conversions rather than waste products trying to do something fancy with what you're, with your raw materials.
So what's the conversion or what's the... a formula for anything lactic wise? I know if we look at sugar, yeast, byproducts, carbon dioxide, alcohol, lactic, you're using what exactly?
You're looking at a bacteria that is converting. And now I'm on very thin ice here because I'm not a dairy person or a cheese person, but I. You're looking at conversions of foods into acids primarily, mm-hmm. as opposed to alcohol and carbon dioxide.
Right.
And you wind up with these sort of, you know, sour cream, sour milk sort of things with a little bit of bite to them when you eat them.
Right, which are supposedly healthy as well.
Right. Mm-hmm. And lactic acid. You raise the acid level in food sufficiently and it preserves it, which is... one of the other reasons that you do ferment foods is mm-hmm. that you want to have some kind of a shelf life. A bucket of milk on the shelf lasts a matter of hours.
Right.
And old hard cheese can last a matter of years with a little care and maybe not even that much refrigeration.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
Those kinds of acid levels are important. And they're important in sourdough breads. One of the biggest differences between sourdough breads, for instance, and breads that use commercial yeast is that the sourdough cultures tend to bring with them this kind of lactic acid fermentation as well. So you get a raised acid level in the bread. In fact, the sour in sourdough is more due to the acids in the bread than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
And that gives you better shelf life. So if you have a bread with a really serious acid profile to it, it'll last... for a long time, like, excuse me, maybe weeks without it'll get stiff, but it won't necessarily then get moldy and become inedible.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas your average loaf of white bread that you buy down at the store, if you leave it out...
Shelf life's pretty low.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So then going back to the history of fermented foods, there's things that we think we pass in the grocery store, i.e. miso, kimchi, mm-hmm. things that for years had been probably saving the diets of a lot of people who were either, well, I mean, not saving the diets, but in terms of cultural aspects of food and where they are today, we don't necessarily think of those foods as fermented, like miso, you know, not too many people
know.
No,
that's true. And it is. Mm-hmm. And they've been doing it in the Far East. Things like miso have been around for centuries.
Mm-hmm.
Things like dry salamis, which are also a fermented product, have been around for centuries with no refrigeration. And if carefully done, you're not poisoning people.
Right. Do you think that was incited by the hot climates, or just taste preferences, health benefits, or all of the above?
It is, again, something that is sort of shrouded in time. Why somebody would have, I could see why you would take a look at a salami, a casing, mm-hmm. which is basically nothing more than a cleaned out intestine of a pig or a lamb or whatever. And you got this animal that you don't want to waste any bits of, so you chop off you can't get all of it off except in little pieces, and so you shove them into this little casing, and again, somebody probably left one out and or hung it someplace and forgot about it and went back a couple of weeks later. And lo and behold, the thing was now hard and dried and it tasted absolutely marvelous. And those are really old, old techniques. People have been preserving food with salt since, 10,000 years. And so the salt and the fermentation sorts of things go hand in hand in terms of preservation. And so mm-hmm. those have all been around a lot longer than guys with calculators and really heavy-duty scales to weigh things out to the nearest microgram and so on. So
right. You have the pleasure of using them and you're cooking mm-hmm. all year round.
Absolutely. Absolutely. If you have, if you don't have fresh milk available to you in the middle of the winter, you may have some cured milk product that you can use that does perfectly well, and they add their own flavor and their own sparkle with the acids in them.
Mm-hmm. I was also reading somewhere that in sea voyages, some of the sailors would be taking fermented foods to prevent scurvy.
I could see if somebody were taking some like fermented vegetables that might do it. My vague recollection of scurvy is that it's a vitamin C problem, and so that's why they discovered quite by accident that things like limes and lemons were a real good thing.
Right.
But if you have preserved a lot of vegetables have very high levels of vitamin C in them, and if you've got them preserved that way, they'll last a long, long time.
On those long voyages
absolutely.
You wouldn't see anything fresh for months.
Months yeah. and months, and the water is turned some unbelievable color, and the other stuff has started to grow green fur, then yeah, you're going to want to do that.
Great. Well, this is a first part of a two-part series we're going to be doing with Dick on fermentation. The second will be aired next week. So I wanted to thank you so much for your time today. It's just a brief introduction to what fermentation is for our listeners. And we'll get a little bit more into it next week as well.
Great. My pleasure.
Okay. Thanks again to our sponsor, Testa Wines, and to our listeners for joining us this afternoon at the Heritage Radio Network at the Root of It.
Stop. You know,